Right, hi everyone. This is not gonna work. Sorry, there was only one lapel mic, so I just had to wait for that one. All right, well, thanks for accommodating the change in time. I think it was great to hear from Robin this morning, and I won't repeat the various issues she ran through. Instead, today, I am gonna talk about our public advice and guidance. I was here last year, not in this, I think we were in a different venue last year, but I was speaking to you all last year about our public advice and guidance system. I went through the history of the system, how we have such a range of advice products that we produce, how we go about choosing one product over another, and the flexibility that we built into the system to make sure we deliver advice the way the community needs it. Now, hopefully you can just breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. I don't plan to go through all of that again this year. My team quite helpfully gave it to me, said, here you go, you can do this presentation again. I thought, oh, I don't know that's going to go down too well if I presented that to you last year. So what I thought I'd do this year is mainly focus on actual advice products that we've put out over the last year. I'll do it though in the context of the system and explain, you know, what, you know, the types of products we put out, but using actual examples. So if you want to get into any of the detail of that, we can. Alrighty, so as you can just see in this snapshot here, there are heaps of examples about how we can respond to the unique needs of the tax system and the types of things we can put out there in the public domain. Now, amongst this whole array of products, our most formal products are our public rulings, which includes our taxation rulings, TRs, and our taxation determinations, TDs. So when you're looking at our public rulings, these are the most technical of our products. They set out the technical interpretation, the commissioner's view of how the tax law works. And really they're predominantly aimed at the tax profession and people who want to get a better understanding of our detailed technical analysis as to how we've arrived at our views. Our web content would tend to capture the upshot of our views, but the rulings will set out the hows and whys. They're our legally binding products, so they will provide the highest level of protection to taxpayers because they will have our legally reasoned position. But I will just caution that being our most formal product, they are actually the most involved internally for us to produce. So when I talk about products with the most detailed technical analysis of our views, the issues that are most benefiting of these kinds of products being produced tend to be the most controversial issues, the ones where the most contentious, the areas where people really do want to understand our view. So in order to produce a draft public ruling, we have to first of all be able to produce a considered and reasoned view to put out to the public. So naturally, that can take time. It does, particularly with the contentious issues, require quite a lot of engagement amongst all of our internal stakeholders across the ATO, including even when we're producing a tax ruling and that's signed off either by myself or one of the deputy chief tax counsels who reports to me. We still need to get sign off and agreement with compliance as well. So we want to make sure that, you know, if we are putting out a view, that they're ready to administer that in accordance with that view. We might need to consider if we need some companion products like practical compliance guidelines to set out some boundaries and that type of thing. So it's quite involved internally. There will be significant points of escalation. As I said, it will be signed off at least at the deputy commissioner level. And it also involves consideration of external stakeholders as well, quite understandably. Even before we get to public consultation through publishing a draft determination or draft ruling, we'll quite often consult in targeted ways with members of the tax profession. We quite often discuss our views, as Tim knows, in our stewardship groups like the NTLG or the various market-based stewardship groups that we've got. And importantly, we also will, on the key issues, consult with our independent public rulings panel. Now, this is a bit of a closed shop. It's an opportunity for the commissioner to test our views with an independent panel before putting it out externally for public consultation. And this public rulings panel that we have is external respected members of the tax profession, including ex-federal court judges. So when we put out our view in a tax ruling or tax determination, we're usually pretty, even on the most controversial, contentious issues, it's usually at least a very well considered view. You might not all agree with it, but we have taken quite a lot of steps before we get there and put it out. Now, in terms of issues, like I say, we look to put out rulings on the areas where we might need to explain our reasoning of contentious issues. But it will be challenging, even if there is a desire for advice from the ATO to put out a view on all things. In particular, forming a considered view can be quite challenging if the law itself is in a state of flux. So if we're aware of the law being reformed, it would be ill-advised usually to firm up our view on the current law, risk confusing people as to how it's going to be administered if the law itself is changing, and including, of course, if the law is being tested before the courts. We might just pause doing our public rulings on that. But that's not to say with those contentious issues, even when the law is in a state of flux, that we would just look to exit the field entirely. Just because we might not push forward a tax ruling or a tax determination, we'll still look to see what kind of advice we should be providing and what kind of certainty we should give. And just, for example, the updating that we've done just recently of our interim decision impact statement in the Bendel case is an example of that. Obviously, the law is still in a state of flux. We're not going to update our rulings, but we are trying to signal our position, our administrative position there. So we will do that quite a lot. Another area where traditionally we didn't do much, where we saw the law as relatively evolving, was new law. It used to be our position that when there's new law that's recently enacted, we will, you know, if people want to understand how the law works, that's what the EM is for. And it would be unwise of us to rush in quickly to clarify elements of new law when that was Parliament's job in the first place. Instead, we'd sit back, see how it operated in practice, and if there were issues that blew up, we would then look to get involved. Now, the new way that we're doing things more recently is saying, well, yeah, that's true. We might not know everything from day one that the law is enacted, but working with stakeholders in the law design process, quite often there'll be things that come to our attention to say, well, look, not everything's going to be covered in the EM. There might be some particular areas where people do want to know our view from the get-go. And that's where we introduce law companion rulings, the idea being that they are a companion product to the new law. I think it was well intended, and we still do them, but some of the issues we've seen in practice when we've tried to produce law companion rulings is, understandably, during the law design process, if there's a problem with the policy or the way that we think the policy is being implemented through the design of the law itself, any stakeholders involved in consulting on that new law understandably are putting all their efforts into, quite rightly, trying to get the law right. And if you can't clarify everything in the law, then you put all your energies into making sure it's all in the EM. And public advice and guidance is really the third tier. So we don't get a great deal of engagement early on because, understandably, we're looking into the law itself. The other thing we've worked out is quite often the issues that do arise on implementation of new or on enactment of new law are less about the detail of what the law actually says. Usually, if there's problems with how the law has been drafted, they don't reveal themselves until a bit later. But rather, what a lot of stakeholders are concerned about is, well, what is the ATO going to do? It's not really how is the ATO going to interpret it, but what are we going to be interested in? So we've found that, we do still do law companion rulings, but more and more with new legislation, we're also turning our minds to whether we also look to do quite early practical compliance guidelines to say, well, as we are transitioning into this new regime, this is what's going to attract the ATO's attention, or if you're going to restructure, here's what's not going to concern us, or things of that nature. So you'll see that more and more. All right, so that's probably the end of my spiel on the ruling system. I thought now I'd get into some of the examples, and I will, when I get to things outside of the ruling system itself, I'll give you a bit of a spiel on the other products as well. So unless there was any, happy to take questions from the floor, or not sure how we can do it with the online audience, but if there's any questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, I'll just go straight into some examples. All right, so we spoke last night about Division 7A in Bendel. The other hot issue for the middle market, of course, is 99B. This is off the back of last year I was talking to you about our public advice and guidance on 100A. Now we've got 99B. Now, I have to say, I was very, very hesitant to do much on 99B. I'd seen it in 100A, where it's a little bit, people wanted to know what our view is, and we told them, and then they wished that we had kept the genie in the bottle, perhaps. And 99B worried me. It probably was time that we had to do something on it. It's a provision that's been in the law since 1979. Up until recently, there's been very little guidance from the ATO on 99B and very little judicial authority on 99B. But what we were seeing in recent times is really an increase in immigration into Australia, a growth of overseas transactions and cross-border transactions, and we were seeing an increase in foreign trusts distributing to Australian residents. And amongst other things, that would potentially increase the incidence of the potential operation of 99B. Now, the other thing we were seeing, to be perfectly frank, is an increase in professional curiosity as to the full scope of 99B. We were seeing on the conference circuit, at Tax Institute events such as this and other conferences, real questions being asked about, well, when does 99B apply? What is the scope? How far will the commissioner take it? And really the question being left unanswered was an unsatisfactory state of being. That doesn't mean, though, that I was overly happy with this situation, because I thought, wow, people are asking the question, but it's a little bit treacherous to put out a view on how a very widely drafted provision applies. It might be a situation where the technical answer is undesirable, so to speak. Anyway, but we had this conversion of concerns. We were seeing transactions that might attract 99B. People were asking the question. We really had to do something about it. And I just want to say thank you to you and the profession for working with us on this. We spoke to quite a lot of the stewardship groups and the and Tax Institute and other advisors to really help us figure out how we could most sensibly and helpfully clarify the law on 99B without upsetting everything entirely. And through this early consultation, this targeted consultation we did prior to doing anything on 99B, we worked out that rather than a warts and all technical ruling describing the full parameters of when Section 99B may or may not apply, what was most desirable was a compliance approach, practical examples, and then some limited binding advice, some limited public ruling advice on bespoke areas of contention. So that's what you'll see we actually delivered. So in terms of the public ruling on 99B, it's not a complete dissertation on the full parameters. What it is just binding views on how the hypothetical resident taxpayer test in Section 99B works. So very, very broadly put, not all of you will be loving all the detail of 99B, sorry, but very, very broadly put, if a resident taxpayer receives an amount from a trust that would not be assessable to a hypothetical resident taxpayer in Australia, then you might be within the scope of the 99B carve-outs, right? So the question is, would it be assessed to a hypothetical resident taxpayer? But the question is, well, how do those tests work? What is a hypothetical resident taxpayer? So in our determination, we clarified that this hypothetical taxpayer, the only characteristic that taxpayer has is residency. That's it. They're an Australian resident taxpayer. They're not a taxpayer that's a particular entity type. They're not a company. They're not an individual. They're not a super fund. They're just a hypothetical resident. And that has implications on whether or not an amount received by them may or may not be assessable. We've said that the circumstances of how the trust derived the amount that this hypothetical taxpayer is receiving is relevant. So if the trust, for example, distributes proceeds of sale of an asset to a hypothetical resident taxpayer and the asset was acquired 10 years ago for a certain price, the cost base of that asset can be taken into account. The working out the profit can be taken into account in working out what would be the tax position of this hypothetical resident taxpayer. And lastly, we said that it's appropriate to look behind the amount to the full circumstances of that amount could be taken into account. So again, where the amount was sourced from will be relevant in determining what is assessable or otherwise to the hypothetical resident taxpayer. So that was the most technical views. When I get to talk about practical compliance guidelines, I'll talk about the other elements of 99B. But I will just say that overall, I think this technical views on very bespoke elements of 99B, coupled with broad practical compliance guidelines on how we will apply it, has actually been, unless you tell me otherwise, I think broadly pretty well received, and I think hopefully has dodged some areas of concern. So I think we've landed in a pretty good place on that one. Some other things we've been looking at over this last year since I last spoke to you is quite a lot happening in the GST space. There has been considerable public advice and guidance in GST in the last 12 months. Firstly, I just want to, again, recap on what I said last year. I told you last year that we were going to be doing what we say we're going to do. Up until that point, previously we had, and we still have, an advice under development program, which is on our public website. But when we first started looking at public advice and guidance in recent years, we noticed that the advice under development program had become a list of good intention, you know, lists of issues that once upon a time people thought it might be a good idea to do something on, and the list was long and it wasn't moving. I told you last year we were going to be looking at that and getting it moving, and that's exactly what we have done, and GST is included in that. Along on that list of aged ideas was something to do with burial rights. It is a bespoke issue, but a very controversial issue for those to whom it's close to. But we finally did get that, our view finalised on GST burial rights recently. So this deals with whether a burial right in a public cemetery is subject to GST. So that's done now. More topically, not an aged matter, but a new matter, we've also just put out a GST tax determination on sunscreen. This got a bit of media coverage. It's not actually not a new view, but it was just a clarification of our view based on some cases we were seeing where our view wasn't understood. Simply put, we've long been of the view that a sunscreen marketed as such is GST-free. But modern products include things that aren't sunscreens, such as cosmetics, that include SPF. And so we've said they're not marketed as sunscreen, they're not sunscreen, and they're not GST-free. So that's our view on that one. And then the other public advice and guidance we've got on GST really is an illustration of how we do respond to changing states of the law. Here I'm talking about changing states of the law based on judicial authority. So both of the GST rulings that are up on the screen there relate to ATM service fees and financial supplies. And these were both updated following the 2023 BankTech decision. Now, in BankTech, the AAT is only a tribunal decision, but the AAT did uphold our view that withdrawal from cash-out facilities from FPOS machines were not ATM services, and therefore not input taxed. So, well, fees in respect of those services are not input taxed, and we've updated our rulings following that decision. Fees are not all just in the GST space, though. We've also put out some guidance on fees in the income tax space. We did finalise in September our binding TDs on deductions for financial advice fees paid by individuals who aren't carrying on a business. So, new tax determination that we put out last year updates our old tax determination that had been around since the 1990s. And I'd just call this one out as another instance where landing our advice really was benefited from the consultation with industry. This particular issue was really just brought to our attention by the Financial Advice Association Australia. They were concerned that, you know, in the 30 years since our old advice was issued, things had changed. There'd been a lot of regulatory changes, and the way that financial advice was provided had changed. So undertaking that advice, whilst we didn't move away from our core technical decision, we were able to better explain in our new TD the delineation between the positive and the negative limbs of Section 8.1 when it comes to providing advice on a proposed investment. We've included now advice on deductibility of fees for advice on income protection insurance, and we have also provided our views on the deduction of advice under the tax-related expenses provision in 25.5, along with updating it for contemporary examples. So that was that one is good to have finalised as well. Now, there's a whole lot happening in the international tax space. Be interesting to see what I'll be saying on that if I'm talking to you 12 months from now, but certainly looking back over the last 12 months, it continued to be the case that there was a lot of international collaboration and an advancement of new regimes in respect of countering profit shifting and base tax erosion, a lot of international agreement on that and a bit of flux in the law. It's also a space where making sure multinationals pay the right amount of tax, notwithstanding the fact that the tax gap in that market is very low, still continues to be quite an area of focus for the ATO. And some of the complexities of the arrangements in that space really do warrant careful consideration and support through public advice and guidance. If just to call out a few in this space, at the beginning of last financial year, we did publish our TD clarifying certain aspects of the hybrid mismatch rules. In particular, there were some definitional elements to those rules that have been causing some confusion. Again, people may not necessarily agree with our position, but we've now made it very, very clear in our TD how we think those rules work. And then more recently, you will have seen and you'll continue to see a suite of public advice and guidance to support the implementation of the new thin cap rules. This one is probably a good example too of us putting into action what we agreed to do following review into how we go about producing advice and guidance on new law. Here we worked very closely with stakeholders after the law design phase to very much understand and narrow down what the key priority issues are that people wanted public advice and guidance on. An area where we have fallen into the trap in the past is when you get stakeholders who are intensely interested in and knowledgeable about an issue, it's very, very easy to end up with a laundry list of things that we could provide advice on. Everyone wants their issue dealt with, and including on the ATO side, our people working on law design too are very passionate about making it work and they want to clarify everything. But in the past, that has actually led to quite delayed advice coming out. And then ultimately, whilst we do provide a suite of advice, there's too big a gap between the law being implemented and people understanding our views. So very clearly through this review of new law guidance, we were told people would much rather, in hindsight, they would much rather early advice on key issues rather than comprehensive advice later. Now, it is a bit of a battle. We have put out early advice on these thin cap rules and we're getting asked, well, why haven't you done it on XYZ as well? So it is a little bit of a battle to try to maintain that best practice, but I think we're landing that pretty well. We'll continue to consult with stakeholders though on what more is needed and make sure that we're addressing the needs there. If any questions, just shout out. Otherwise, I'll go to Super anyway.
Yeah, I have a question, actually.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad I'm not in caretaker, but no, certainly not my place to comment on the political reaction to our views. We are very apolitical, so we will just administer the law. The commissioner is an independent statutory administrator, and it's certainly, a feature of a healthy tax system that people have their views on how it operates. And I will say it's obviously within government's control as to what law is enacted that we are then tasked with administering. Was that adequate? Alrighty. And this one's being filmed too, so it's harder. Alrighty, so I'm moving out of the superannuation space. This is another area where constantly there are peculiarities in the rules that really do benefit from having a full technical analysis and having the support of public advice and guidance. We did work through a relatively tricky issue published at the start of this financial year relating to the ever popular NALI rules, non-arm's length income rules, and here it was a question of how the NALI rules interact with a situation where a fund has made a non-arm's length capital gain that's included in the calculation of an overall net capital gain, because it's only the net capital gain that's included in income, not each individual gain. So it's just a bit of a technical complexity, and I think we found a sensible way through that in our tax determination, and we've set out there how we think those rules can be applied. Superannuation is another one too, where the law is not necessarily a set and forget, and we have had a lot of changes, and our public advice and guidance is updated to reflect that. I've got a pretty good example, I think. I was pretty pleased with my team for this one. On the 16th of December last year, we published a taxation ruling to explain our views on the operation of the First Home Super Saver Scheme. In particular, some updates to that scheme that were introducing some new transitional arrangements. Now, those transitional arrangements, noting we put our advice out on the 16th of September, they started on the 15th of September. So it took us one day and we got the advice on the transitional arrangements. Those transitional arrangements apply from 3 years from the 15th of September last year. So that's there. Not only did we do our updated binding public ruling or public determination on this one, but we also issued at the same time a guidance note to help funds themselves comply with these new rules and updated our web content. So you've got that whole suite of things. However people wanted to receive that information, it's updated and consistent. I think that was all I really wanted to highlight with our public, sort of key public... our key public rulings for the last 12 months. But it's not just our public rulings that we produce in terms of advising how the system works. There's a whole suite of general and administrative guidance we produce as well. And I think very much this does have its place. Sometimes we get a little bit of criticism for some of the general advice we provide, but I think it's a bit of a cornerstone in helping the population more generally understand the tax system. So a lot of our general and administrative guidance is a lot more accessible and certainly contains less technicalities than our public rulings. We can also use our general and administrative guidance to provide advance warning on things that we're seeing that might raise some concerns with us, but that we're yet to have gone through that full technical analysis, including some of the steps I mentioned at the beginning with the long process that that takes. So we can just get our signals into the market a bit earlier so you know what we're thinking. And we also have increasingly used our general and administrative guidance to give you much greater transparency into how we go about our task of administering the law, in particular what's going to attract our attention and where we're going to be focusing our compliance efforts. This in particular is something that I think when people are unfamiliar with the products have raised some concerns. If we say we're going to look at something, there is a concern that that's then us rushing to a legal answer. I just tell you that's not how we see this. If we say we're going to look at something, it means we will look at it and then we will work through with you on the facts of your case as to how the law might apply. So very much our general and administrative guidance are not our legally binding products. With that in mind, I will say it's very important to remember our general guidance can only go so far. Our ability to administer the tax system is not unconditional. It does have to be within the confines of the law. So I have, just reflecting on our Bendel discussion yesterday, I have seen some catchy tax blog videos suggesting that the commissioner is not above the law. I would wholeheartedly agree with that. We certainly will stay within the confines of the law in terms of how we try to make the system work. But that doesn't mean we still can't say some things of general in a general nature that can be helpful. So probably the starting at the opposite end of our public rulings, I'll just touch on just some of our web guidance. This really is right at the other end of our rulings. It's very much targeted at a broad audience, very non-technical, but nonetheless really tries to play a very practical way in helping users of the tax system understand the tax system. We use web guidance just to provide the general explanation. We also use general web guidance if we want to get some messages out quickly. It can be very, very helpful in times of natural disaster. It was very helpful in COVID just to explain our position very quickly to any users of the tax system. I've got our recent examples are probably not as punchy and as dramatic as what we saw in COVID times, but just reflecting on some of our web guidance in the last 12 months, we have updated our promoter penalties web content to reflect the regulatory changes there. We've updated our PRRT, our petroleum resource rent tax guidance, given that there's new financial year limits. We've put in some new web guidance on FBT exemption eligibility for electric vehicles, and as I touched on, we've updated our first home super saver scheme guidance. The thing I will just point out though, I won't go through the detail of this, it is just our web guidance, but you'll see for each of our web content now, we do have, I've got those QC numbers written down against each of our web pages. I think this is just an important one that I did want to bring to your attention. We do put those numbers now at the bottom of each of our web pages. We've always said that we'll stand by the guidance we put out there, but this does help give you greater assurance of that, because web pages can change from time to time, but having these numbers that are quotable and that we know that what you can refer back to, I think just gives you that additional assurance over our web content. Another part of our administrative guidance that I've mentioned a couple of times already is our practical compliance guidelines. These ones, as I mentioned, I do think can be quite helpful in explaining how we undertake our task of administration. Even when our interpretive view is very clear, sometimes it is helpful to know that how we might approach our task of administering that clear interpretive position. What does it really mean in practice? In our practical compliance guidelines, we will tend to put out scenarios that we'll be thinking about, and we try to make them as much as possible things that people can relate to. So have you got scenarios similar to your own? Is it a scenario that the Commissioner is going to be interested in or not interested in? Obviously, we don't have resources to look at everything. We will tell our compliance teams the kinds of things that they should be looking into. There's whole compliance programs dedicated to this. And practical compliance guidelines are really about trying to link what you're seeing with what we're doing. So give you some insights into how we're going to be applying the law. They are very practical. They are very bespoke, depending on what topic we're explaining. So it's not really a one size fits all. But in short, a lot of practical compliance guidelines will tend to explain arrangements that we see as either being higher risk or lower risk. And in general, higher risk arrangements that we see are more likely to attract our attention. And for lower risk arrangements, we might be as explicit as saying we're not going to apply any compliance resources to specifically look at these things. Again, they're not statements of the law. It may very well be pretty often the case that the things that we're not going to look at would not fall foul of the law anyway. The inverse is not necessarily true. Just because we're looking at something doesn't mean that relevant adverse provisions will apply to those arrangements. It just means that we're going to look at it and to understand if the provisions do apply. So, yeah, certainly they are just there for some transparency. Anyway, true to my word, I'm going to try to give you some examples and not just the theory. Okay, great. So I've got some of the thin cap examples up there. This one, what we thought would be helpful as people are entering into the new thin cap regime is if people have got old structures or existing structures that they think maybe would be that they may be better placed to be in a different structure under a new regime. We are aware that people would be potentially looking to restructure out of arrangements that may otherwise fall foul of the new thin cap rules. That's completely reasonable, and what we've tried to do is explain in our practical compliance guidelines the kinds of restructures that we think are reasonable and the areas where we might think that would cause us some areas of concern. So that one we've worked quite closely with stakeholders on. We think that's probably a key product to get out there very early on in this new regime. In the superannuation space, I spoke earlier about a range of issues involving fees. I spoke about it in GST, I spoke about it in income tax. It's also been an issue in the super space, and there were some law changes here, essentially to allow the trustees of super funds in some cases to pay for advice fees for their members. We have put out a practical compliance guideline which helps funds understand methodologies for calculating the deductions for fees that they pay under these new rules, and also to highlight where certain arrangements or certain deductions being claimed might attract our attention. So the rules are permissive, but you know they only go so far. So we have been consulting on this PCG, so it is just still a draft, but we've got a lot of good feedback on this one, and we'll be looking to finalising this one shortly. I've already mentioned the 99B practical compliance guideline. After taking you through the technicalities of what we covered in our TD, I won't go through much detail of our PCG, but I will say what we did based on feedback here. We thought it would be most helpful to explain the common scenarios where we would see 99B as potentially applying, so where it is the ATO is going to deliberately focus our efforts in considering the application of 99B. Equally, we thought it was very important to have a clear compliance approach for certain arrangements where we would not seek to actively apply 99B, in particular distributions from non-resident deceased estates and under what parameters we wouldn't look to consider the application of 99B there, and also for the use of trust property. These were two hot issues that came up through consultation, and we've addressed our views on those in the PCG. The last thing we did in the 99B PCG was try to help at least set out the Commissioner's views on what kind of record keeping or practical aspects of record keeping could be very helpful to try to have the information needed to assure us that the relevant exceptions apply. So if you're looking at saying a hypothetical taxpayer wouldn't be assessed on these amounts, all we see on our side, we might have an AUSTRAC record that says this amount of money has been received. So what do you need to show us to say, no, this is from this type of asset and it's from trust capital or whatever the case may be. It's very, very hard given that we are looking at predominantly foreign trusts, so it's hard for you to have all that information. So we've tried to, on our PCG, give some suggestions of what kind of records might be helpful if you're in the situation that otherwise 99B might be in question. And again, a big thanks to the profession here, because I think we've landed some pretty good advice there through your input. So thanks very much for that one. Probably a bit more controversial is we have late last year put out a practical compliance guideline on the personal services businesses and personal services income rules and how those rules may or may not interact in certain arrangements with the Part 4A or the general anti-avoidance rules in Part 4A. Now, this one, I think, again, through talking to practitioners, is useful to put out a product on this one, because we were seeing a lot of misconceptions that if you're in the PSI rules, you're exempt from all other integrity rules. That's certainly not the case. We have taken that cue to say, okay, we need to address these misconceptions, and we've come out and we've said, okay, not only can they interact, but here's some examples of where Part 4A might be in question. Through consultation, the period for consultation, the formal period has closed, but we continue to engage with the profession. Through that consultation, we have become understandably aware that, okay, that's all good, Commissioner, you might tell us where it might be a problem, but can you also tell us where it's not a problem? And we might need to think about that. I will say, just as a general rule, it's a little bit challenging and probably not something we often do to say this is a Part 4A or a general anti-avoidance rule free zone, because the whole nature of the general anti-avoidance rule are people putting in deliberate steps to try to avoid tax outcomes. So we certainly don't want to set up a situation where people are deliberately finding themselves into a known zone. But we are going to take that feedback on board and see if we can be a little bit more practical with that, or a little bit more helpful with that practical compliance guideline. But nonetheless, what's out there in draft does give you an indication of areas where we will currently have some concerns. So it's not just PCGs. We've also got we've got a range of products which are designed for instruction for our staff. These are instruction for our staff. We instruct our staff, you know, we're a large organisation. We have a lot of, as every organisation does, procedures and whatnot that our staff have to follow. A lot of our procedures are just administrative procedures that any business has. But some of our procedures relate to how staff go about their jobs in interpreting the law, or you know, some of the procedures we have for our staff do relate to something that's a little bit tax technical. So for those ones, we might not tell you what our we might not publish all of our procedures, like rules for lunch breaks and that type of thing, but if we are, if we're telling our staff how to go about their job interpreting the law, we do publish those. So these are staff instructions, but are published so you can see what we're telling our staff. I think this, again, helps you to have transparency into how we do our job in administering the law and make sure that you understand what to expect from the ATO. So, like, staff procedures, I mean, they can all get updated from time to time. Probably in the procedures with regards to law space, there tends to be a few things that that might trigger some updates. Of course, if the law has changed or, you know, through legislation, decisions, etc., we will look to our practice statements and see if there are any updates needed. And a couple of the examples there go to that. Certainly, the updates to the promoter penalty laws saw us updating our 2021 procedures on that. And recently, there were some changes to our tax secrecy provisions, and in particular, when we might be able to share information concerning any suspected breaches of confidentiality obligations owed to the Commonwealth. That's obviously something that we take very seriously. If we don't share information that we're prohibited under our secrecy provisions from sharing, with updates to those rules, we've now had to tell our staff that, you know, if you see these breaches, this is how you go about sharing the information. We also, it's not all just law change. Sometimes we will look at other, you know, from time to time, you just update your procedures in general. But another trigger for it might be recommendations coming out of the Inspector General. The former Inspector General last year did conclude a review into the so-called general powers of administration. Through that review, we did review our procedures on how the Commissioner administers the law in general, so the general operation of our role as administrators. We have, as a result, updated our instructions for staff on this, in particular by clarifying the level of sign-off needed if there is going to be a so-called general power of administration exercised. It's more of an obligation than a power, but I think that tends to be how it's known, so hopefully you understand what I mean there. But also, yeah, if you want to have a look at that, we have updated those procedures. I might come back to this if I've got time at the end. This is just some stats about the difference between our PCGs and rulings. Spoiler alert, if I don't have time to come back to it, we are still producing rulings. They're not being crowded out by our practical compliance guidelines. Typically, they tend to be produced by different areas of the ATO anyway, so the stats do support that we are not... Actually, the other thing I will just say quickly, not only do we continue to produce our binding rulings, more and more, that blue line there is we're updating existing rulings. So rather than just adding to the volume, I think a mature tax system, and it's a good indication of a mature system, is we look to see what's there and make sure we keep it contemporary, keep it current. So we are certainly focusing on that. In case I don't have time to come back to it. Okay, the last bit of PAG that I wanted to talk about are some other products that we have that might be good signals for you to consider, that are early warnings or give you some indication of the kinds of areas where we might be looking to either produce new public advice and guidance or update existing public advice and guidance into the future. The first one that I'll talk about is our taxpayer alerts. Now, these are a product in and of themselves. So certainly the main game of taxpayer alerts is to provide early warning of arrangements that we're seeing that cause us some concern, and just to let you know that we're looking into these. Then what we will tend to do in most cases is say, okay, we'll actually then consider the arrangements that concerned us, work through the provisions, and then tend to provide our detailed reasoning in public advice and guidance following that taxpayer alert. Not always the case if it's general anti-avoidance. We, again, don't often do bespoke advice on general anti-avoidance. We do sometimes, and I'll give you an example of one. But again, taxpayer alerts not only alert you to the arrangement, but they will sometimes alert you to PAG to come. I'm going to take you through an example. Let's see how I go with this, and I'm conscious of time. Alrighty, so one of the alerts I wanted to talk about was a recent one we put out late last year, and this is going to work great, involving early stage investors. I'm going to be a bit old school, and it's going to be impossible for me to talk about the example without putting it up, I think. All right, so what this is the arrangement we're seeing. It's in, if you want to know about it in more detail, is in that taxpayer alert 24/1. But I'm just going to give you a summary of what the what we think the arrangement is. Now, before I go into the example, anyone that is not familiar with this regime, essentially the early stage investor tax offset is an incentive for people who invest into the early stage innovation entities, and the incentive awards them with a 20% tax offset. So that's the structure of it generally. What we're seeing though is you might have this investor here, right? And the investor is looking, either looking for a tax offset or approached about, do I have a deal for you? The investor, let's just take an example, borrows $50,000 from a lender. The investor then uses that $50,000 to invest in the eligible investment business. And then, having invested $50,000, they get their 20% offset. So the ATO gives them the $10,000 tax offset. So if that's all that happens, that's actually exactly how it's intended to work. So no real harm there. But under this arrangement that we're seeing, after this has all happened, the eligible investment business decides to buy back its shares. But it buys them back for a discount. It buys them back, in this example, say for $45,000. And it keeps the $5,000 itself. The investor takes the $10,000 it's received from the ATO along with the $45,000, so it's got $55,000 in its pocket, repays the loan, and it also keeps the $5,000. So we see here you've got the company and the investor each pocketing $5,000, funded purely from the tax offset and no real investment. Shouldn't come as a huge surprise that we have some concerns with this. It's all explained in our taxpayer alert. I said we don't often put up rulings on Part 4A. This is an exception to that, though. In February this year, we finalised a tax determination explaining our view about how Part 4A might apply to this exact arrangement. So the alert is the signal, and the tax determination is our technical view. And I hope that wasn't permanent, but anyway, I've got one more example to go through too. Maybe we can flip this. I'll use a different colour. All right, okay, so the next example I wanted to go through is Division 7A. It's like a little bit of an easier one to follow, might not need to put it up. But essentially what we're seeing here is an arrangement that we thought perhaps, under our alert, we think maybe this kind of arrangement is really designed to avoid Division 7A. You've got a private company here with profits. It wants to make a distribution out to its shareholders. It's got profits, doesn't have cash. Maybe it would borrow funds to get some distributions out to the shareholders. Obviously, though, worried about Division 7A. These are in the arrangements we're seeing that do concern us. I'm not saying everyone would do it this way, but these would be a concern. We've seen an arrangement whereby a related entity, let's call it borrower, is introduced to borrow money from the bank instead of the private company borrowing it. So the money comes in here. The borrower pays the funds out to the shareholder, but the private company is the one guaranteeing the loan. So the risk is here, the money flows there. We say this is one where we actually put out a taxpayer alert and a determination on the same day. We say here it's pretty straightforward application of 109U in Division 7A. We do think there that in this kind of arrangement, 109U would be triggered, and essentially the operation of 109U in this case would be to deem the private company to have made the payment to the shareholder or associate. Regular Division 7A rules will then apply. The other one that I don't have many notes on, it's just hot off the press. We have put out last week a taxpayer alert to do, this is in the international space, to do with captive managed investment trusts. Essentially, the issue here that raises some concerns with us is if you've got an investor into Australia That's eyeing off a 15% tax rate that would be available under the managed investment trust regime. We have seen situations where people are restructuring to interpose a widely held entity to satisfy the MIT rules, but then ultimately the ownership under the structures we're seeing do end up with the same investor. So it's in substance, maybe concerns about whether it's widely held. That's why we call them captive MITs. We're looking into these arrangements, but we've just last week put out an alert to signal that this is attracting our attention. We have, however, said that in the same alert, not often we do this, but in the same alert, we've also called out things that won't attract our attention. So it's not going to be a matter of us going back or looking at things that don't involve the restructures. All right, better keep moving. The other area where you might get some signals about where we might be doing some public advice and guidance or updating our public advice and guidance is in our decision impact statements. Decision impact statements, we tend to, if we run any significant litigation, if it's adverse, we will put out a decision impact statement explaining what we'll do with the case. Sometimes even ones that aren't adverse or that are otherwise significant will explain what we see are the implications following from key decisions of the judiciary. There's been a fair few. I didn't really know there was a lot to choose from because we do these as a part, as ordinary course. But I thought I'd call out some that were relatively interesting that we put out over the last since we last spoke. Bowerman, we had that decision. It was quite an interesting decision. It was an odd one where on the facts there was a revenue loss allowed for disposal of a main residence. Interesting facts aside, I just wanted to give this one as an example too, where the decision impact statement itself does flag that we will be considering whether updates are needed to our public advice and guidance on this issue. In particular, is there any element of our 1997 ruling, that's just our basic ruling on 8.1, is there any clarification we need to do to that ruling to explain how 8.1 applies in the case of a loss as distinct from an outgoing? Is there anything from the judgment that we need to pick up in that ruling? If you go to that ruling, you'll see it's been annotated on the top to say it's under review. So that's what I mean by the decision impact statements flagging PAG to come. We also have, under a pseudonym, an R&D case was run. It was GQHC, it was a pseudonym. This case was predominantly important, for us at least, by explaining our role as a dual administrator of the R&D rules. It did confirm that the Commissioner is entitled to make an assessment as to the eligibility for the R&D concessions, and we don't just have to be beholden to what has gone before, so that was important for us. But the actual case itself, the core facts of the case, did involve some feedstock activities. So in addition to the core elements of that case, or the reason why we saw it was significant, we also think that it's worth considering our public advice and guidance on feedstock and see if there needs to be any corresponding changes there. And of course, I couldn't not mention Bendel. That one, very clearly, wherever that case lands, it will have implications on our tax rulings there, which, as I mentioned yesterday, in case any of you weren't there, while the case is on foot, our existing rulings remain our view. Lastly, the flagship of where you can go to understand what's to come with our public advice and guidance is, of course, our Advice Under Development program. We keep this published on our website on the ato.gov.au. I am very confident now of the work we've done to clean it up, and I can say with some certainty that everything listed there is under development. It's progressing. Some of them have had many anniversaries, but we have looked over them and we've published what we can. We've actively flagged what we're not doing. So anything that was just once a good idea that we're not doing has now been taken off the register, and what's left there is being actually progressed. Having said that now, so we know what's there is being progressed, you are now in an informed position to tell me if what I've got there is missing something significant. And we do have an email address. It's on you can link through to it from the Advice Under Development program, and it is on my last slide. It's publicguidance@ato.gov.au. But if you look at our Advice Under Development program, you think there's really some key things here that the ATO is not doing that we should be doing public advice and guidance on, please email us. I've got Assistant Commissioner who works for me that will look at everything that comes in. We do take it very seriously because we do need to understand. We only see so much. So if you tell us what's missing, we will have a look at that. which kind of brings me to my next point, which is how do we work out what public advice and guidance to produce? I will say there are no shortage of issues. The tax system is long and complex, and we could write advice and guidance on many, many things. So really the key for us is working out what's most important. What we do to best assess what we think is most important is to consider different indicators of priority. First of all, we look at the community need for public advice and guidance. Now, how do we know this? Well, we might see it through our ruling requests, we might hear about it in conferences such as this, or you might tell us. So that email address is important. If you tell us it's important, if multiple people tell us the same thing is important, that will suggest to us there is some community need. We'll consider the strategic need. This might be through supporting new law. It might be that, in our compliance activities, we're seeing people get something wrong. So people might not be asking for it, but we think, oh, hang on, we need to tell people that we're certainly viewing the law differently than what they're producing. That would be an example of where there's a strategic need. And then finally, and I think importantly, we also think about whether PAG is the only way to address the issue. So what, if not PAG, then what? Just because there's an important issue doesn't mean that it has to necessarily be public advice and guidance. It could be that we just update our tax return instructions. I don't know. There might be other ways of dealing with it. It might be something that, yes, we want to do public advice and guidance, but it's not critical to do it now. There's other more pressing things. This one can wait. So we think about all those things when we're considering our priorities. But as again, I do take the community need very seriously. So again, we just encourage you, let us know if there's something that you think is important. Okay, so I haven't left much time for questions, sorry. But anyway, just on my last slide then, what's in the future? Look, I just want to again reinforce in terms of what's in the future, you very much play a leading role in this. I think the advisors do very much shape and influence the kinds of public advice that the ATO produces. If you can, keep raising issues in conferences like this, we hear about it, we see, look, what can we do to address it? You can tell us about issues. If your approach to engage in targeted consultation or through the Institute, we can get input from targeted consultations. And then, of course, there's just feedback on our draft public rulings, draft determinations. All of that very much helps influence where we're going to land in the future with our public advice and guidance. And then finally, I'll just again underscore, please just tell us if there's something you think we should be looking at. And as always, I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks. That's an interesting one. So the draft, one dear to my heart too. That's a good one. So the draft rulings do represent guidance for our staff. So even while the ruling's not finalised, it does represent instructions to our staff to follow. So that indeed still is the position that ATO staff are following in determining what is net income of a trust estate.
How many concerning arrangements would it take to release a taxpayer alert, and are those concerning arrangements seen through lodged private ruling requests or otherwise?
Oh, okay. Look, this one is a bit of horses for courses. So it's not like you reach a threshold and then we get concerned. Really, ideally, at the earliest stage possible, we should put out a taxpayer alert, because what we don't want to see happen is the proliferation of, someone mentioned before, like the TikTok advice. You don't want to see a proliferation of issues that we're then trying to then work with people saying, oh, you might have spent the money, now we've got to try to get it back from you, this hasn't worked. Much, much better that people can not get themselves into issues in the first place. Again, people can choose to disagree with us, but I'd rather that be a choice. What I don't want to have people doing is going into arrangements thinking that they've got some kind of windfall and then finding themselves in a problem. So if anything, I feel like we should be doing them earlier than we can. But obviously, they take a bit of time sometimes to filter up to the people that might be able to make the decisions to publish them. But no, when we see them in the early stage innovation entity arrangements is an example of that. We saw it and very, very quickly put out a taxpayer alert on that. One here.
Thanks, Fiona. Thanks very much for coming over too. I think it's really good for you to take time out of your busy weeks, I'm sure, to come to WA. An easy one for you on the advice under development. Where are we at with the back-to-back rollovers? The website says early 2025, which I think is now.
Yes. Early to mid, did it say? No. Probably we're not great at estimating timeframes, and I will say we are an independent statutory administrator, but we are not naive as to the realities that we live in, so timing can be sometimes impacted by events external to us. On the back-to-back rollover one too, we just did have the AusNet decision, so I think that will have to be factored into our consideration of our views on back-to-back rollovers. It wasn't directly on point, but there were some elements there of the decision that I think we should rightfully take into account in developing that. I can say, though, again, this is no longer a wish list of good intention. These are things that are under development. Didn't really answer. I don't know the exact day it would come out, but yeah. And oh, sorry, and I should say, if it's not already obvious, once we're in caretaker period, if there's things that we're within our discretion in our administration, we won't look to proactively do anything that might be sensitive. So you will see things typically pausing in caretaker unless it's needed just for the running of our general administration. So that can be a bit of a disruption to the ordinary flow of things as well. Happy to take criticisms or compliments.
Great. Two questions. First one's on 99B. So I note the approach to take the TD rather than the TR, notwithstanding it's old law and it's not for the courts. Is that a change in approach with the ATO that they might take more of a narrow focus, multiple TD approach rather than a single comprehensive TR going forward?
I wouldn't say that's a general change in approach at all. I would say there were some particular... We have got long-standing... we have managed 99B with refrained administration over decades. If you push too hard on what that means as a matter of technicalities, I feel like our administration of 99B ought to be expanded. I don't know that's an area that people would be wanting to urge us down, so we made a very deliberate choice with that particular one to be quite constrained in what we provided views on.
So, yeah, I note the probably the most contentious aspects of 99B wasn't addressed, and that was probably intentional.
I could probably address it. I don't think people would like the view. So, yeah,
but ultimately it gets addressed if it's a PBR process anyway. And that goes to my next question. Where there's a PBR process and it might receive some TCN involvement,
yes. How
do you manage any conflicts with the objection stage, perhaps relying on TC?
Yeah, so we get a new tax council network team to look at the matter on objection. I try at the audit stage to stay. There's a series of escalation points within tax council network, and I do have three deputy commissioners who are deputy chief tax councils. They would be usually the highest escalation point. But certainly if a matter has gone to, in the audit stage and a deputy chief tax counsel has already looked at it, it can be escalated to me on objection.
It's a follow-up to the written question there on TD 2012/D1. Mm-hmm. What is the hold-up? Why can't you finalise it? And if it is because of legislative obscurity, why doesn't the ATO refer that to Treasury and take it back up to government to fix it?
We do have conversations with Treasury. You will not see 2012D1 on our advice under developments. This is not an issue where I've said we're working on that's just been delayed. This one is there as a draft. We're not actively looking to finalise that one. It's certainly not something that we'd be incapable of finalising. So, if people want it finalised, we could look at it, but I don't think we would move too far from where we're at with it. That still does represent the views that our staff are following. So, we have discussed it in various stakeholder groups. So we had taken under advisement as well what people were wanting to see us do there. So Open to different views, but that's where that one's landed at the moment. It did make it a little bit peculiar following Luski. We had to look about whether we updated a draft ruling, which is a bit odd. So it's not an ideal situation that we're in with the way we're administering the taxation of trusts, but it's probably a fraught area. All right. I thought you might raise absolute entitlement. All right, thank you.
Please join us again in thanking Fiona for her presentation.